for the week of December 30th, 2018. The last time we'll be saying that this year, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 433, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at number 10 Downing Street, I'm Michael Giltz. Happy New Year, Sperling.
Why are you at number 10 Downing Street? Are you hanging out with the Prime Minister, not the President, of England?
I would if it was Hugh Grant.
Okay, so this must be a Love Actually reference.
That's right. You went to a multimedia show in L.A. called Love Actually Live, which made its world premiere there. I hadn't even heard about this. It's a weird hybrid, right? They're not doing a stage version of the show, of the movie. They're not doing a musical version. It's just a show where they portray clips of the movie, and they have singers and performers on stage who are like the characters on screen, like Rex Smith played the Bill Nighy character, and they do the songs from the film, and then they show clips from the movie, and they sort of act out scenes, sort of, but it's this weird little thing, but you said it was kind of fun, huh?
Yeah, you know, certainly, look, I mean, people have a love-hate relationship with the movie itself, Love Actually, which was, I think, 2003, 2002, somewhere in there. It has an interwoven storyline of 10 different characters. And so what they do is, on all of these screens on the stage that kind of fly in and fly out, they play different clips of the film, and that's the only talking in the show itself. Everything else with live performers is sung. And, you know, it's got
And they're doing the pop songs from the movie, right? Not new songs. They're doing the pop songs that were featured in the film.
Yes, correct, including the song that Bill Nighy sings, which is the song that Christmas is everywhere. I don't even know the name of the song.
It's a goofy,
It's like he basically plays a character, kind of a washed up rock star who takes one of his hit songs and turns it into a Christmas song, and it becomes the number one song of the Christmas week in the UK. And it was actually quite inventive.
Right. Well, and so you thought it was kind of fun.
I thought it was better than the movie.
Well, there you go. We'll have to see if that has a second life. It seemed to get pretty good reviews, though they took a long time just trying to explain what the hell it was.
It's really it's definitely one of those things where it's like, well, how do you explain this? It's not the movie. It's not a musical. It's a movie musical. It's hard to explain.
Well, but if you had fun, that's all that matters. So it is a holiday film, and we're past the holidays, of course, at least Christmas time. But it is worth noting that Mariah Carey hit number 6 on the Billboard charts with All I Want for Christmas Is You. It's the highest charting holiday song in 60 years. We've had songs that peaked at number 7 from Kenny G and New Kids on the Block. The Band-Aid single, Do They Know It's Christmas? I checked that one out because I thought, what about that? That peaked at number 13. It's been 60 years since a holiday song reached that high up on the charts. It was, the Chipmunk song. That's what it was, from 1958. That was number one for 4 weeks. You think you get sick of it at Christmas time? Imagine that thing, number one for 4 weeks in a row.
Well, imagine this. Back in 1958, they were probably saying, you know, 4 weeks out of Christmas. Why are they playing Christmas songs so early? And now, of course, they start right after Halloween.
That's true. And I think it's cool that the charts are filled with Mariah Carey and Andy Williams and all these old songs, because that's what people are listening to. All the adult contemporary radio stations switch their format over to basically holiday music after Thanksgiving, mostly. Streaming makes on-demand trackable. We can know what people are listening to on demand now, as opposed to before when they just had to switch the radio dial and hope to hear their favorite song. You know, when they stream an album, that's easier to track than when they pull out a Carpenter's album from their LP collection and put that on the turntable. So there's more access to holiday music ever than before, and that's being reflected on the charts, which is what it should always be. In the UK, for years, back to the 70s and 80s, you'd see like a song would be featured in a commercial or in a film, an old tune, and then suddenly be back on the charts. And I could never quite figure out why that happened in the UK, but not the US. It almost never had old songs reigning the charts. And I think it has something to do with payola. I'm just speculating here, but I feel like nobody was paying people at radio stations to report an old song being back on the charts, so they didn't bother. And it's a much bigger market with a lot more control by the PR and the record labels, whereas the UK is just a few stations. There wasn't as much payola. And I think they were more able to reflect what people were actually listening to. And that was healthy because you could see an old Elvis song become a hit. You could see an old Beatles song and suddenly an album would chart that hadn't charted in 20 or 30 years. So, yeah, it's kind of weird to see all these old holiday songs pop up on the charts. But I think it's cool because it reflects what people are actually doing. Just like, you know, the book chart should reflect when people buy Dr. Seuss's, oh, the places you'll go at graduation time.
Well, you know, I wonder if all of the streaming helped Mariah Carey's song chart.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, because ultimately there's a whole bunch of people out there, like everyone, creating these holiday playlists to play in the background of Christmas parties or, you know, at their family get-togethers. And of course, that song gets thrown in or it's on a Pandora station and it just kind of keeps popping up and thus raising the profile of that song during that this time period.
Of course, Mariah Carey set a single day streaming record of 10.8 million streams on a single day. I forget whether that was just Spotify or across the board or whatever in North America, but she set some sort of single day record. So yeah, clearly people are playing the song a lot. And of course, now they're going to be playing our podcast a lot because it's the new year and they want to find out what to think about 2018 and 2019. So what are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to ring in the new year with a rundown of all the big holiday movies and our special guest, Kathy Griffin.
Yay!
Okay, we're not really going to be joined by the comedian, but shouldn't Anderson Cooper feel a little abashed right now? Anyway, it's a slow week for news, so we'll be talking a lot about the new movies of the Christmas season, how they've fared, and the records being set this year in North America, China, and the entire world, although the entire world isn't in yet right now. By the way, who said movie going was dead? I want to know who that was. In the Middle Kingdom, the government is officially relaxing the quotas on foreign films it has unofficially ignored for years. They've got a lot of movie theaters, they're building more every day, and they need some Hollywood films to boost the box office. Case in point, their grosses continue to grow, but they just had the slowest holiday season in 8 years over in China. In sexual misconduct news, Kevin Spacey is being charged with felony sexual assault. So naturally, he released a bizarre video that makes Twitter rants by other celebs seem positively restrained in comparison. On Inside Baseball, we'll delve into a survey commissioned by the North American Theater Owners Association, NATO, that they wondered if streaming, and Netflix in particular, are kneecapping the habit of going to the movies. The answer? It's exactly what they want to hear. Coincidence? We'll find out. Of course, during a very brief Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's handful of top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We pull info from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, the LA Times, the New York Times, you, our listener. And the number one movie around the world is Aquaman. We've got 2 weeks of box office to cover up, and they're two of the biggest weeks of the year, so there's a lot of info here. Aquaman made $135 million over the weekend. It's at $750 million worldwide. It's at $750 million worldwide, and it just made another $130 million. So it's still going really strong. Now, it may fall off a cliff at the end of the holidays because everybody's got to go back to school and work. So it could be a 60, 70% drop next week. But people are saying this could now get to $900 million. This will be the biggest film in the newly launched DC Universe, you know, starting with the new Superman and the new Batman and the other stuff we've got, Wonder Woman. This is their biggest hit so far. So middling reviews, but this sucker is going great at the box office. It could be the biggest DC movie without adjusting for inflation since the Christopher Nolan films, when they last two Dark Knight movies made $1 billion. If this thing has more legs beyond the holidays, it could, you know, it could rival that. That's unbelievable.
Don't you think you should be saying if this thing has more fins after the holidays? Just,
oh, Lord.
Just asking.
And anybody who thinks superhero movies are going to die out anytime soon, no. We had like 20, 30 years of Westerns. That's what we're in for with superhero movies.
Well, you know what? Superheroes can't die. Everybody knows that.
Not when they can always sell more comic books. At number two around the world, franchises can die. Bumblebee, the spinoff from the Transformers flicks, made $66 million over the weekend. It's at $160 million worldwide. We still have China and Japan to come, so the news could get better for this movie. It cost $120 million to make, so it's got a ways to go. But the fact is, Bumblebee has by far the best reviews in the Transformers franchise and by far the worst box office.
Yeah, and you know what? This movie, I've seen about 20, 30 minutes of it. It's actually really good. It's worth seeing.
Well, for a Transformers film, surely.
Well, okay, yeah, fine. If you want to qualify.
It's not one of the best. I mean, have you seen it?
I've seen, like I said, only 20 or 30 minutes.
No, I know, but why not? Why not go to it? Or take your kids?
Well, because I was traveling. Otherwise, yes, I would have seen this movie way over Aquaman. I definitely would have seen this over Aquaman.
Cool.
Which I have not seen, by the way. So.
Right. So you give it the thumbs up.
Yes. Given the 30 minutes that I saw and the people that I know who've seen it and went, actually, it's pretty darn good.
But all of the first four Transformer films were dreadful. Why people kept going, I don't know. The last one or two when they got rid of Shia LaBeouf and they brought in Mark Wahlberg and the bottom fell out, it really collapsed the franchise. And now even when they finally delivered a decent movie that's in the right spirit, they're not able to capitalize on it. So it may be a little while before we see Bumblebee 2. It may also be a while before we see another Mary Poppins films. I'm not sure. This should have legs. We'll see. Mary Poppins Returns opened up two weekends ago. It made $57 million over the weekend. It's at $170 million worldwide. They're lowballing the budget a little bit, I think. $130 million sounds a little small to me for this big, lavish period movie musical. And they keep wanting to compare it to The Greatest Showman. But that movie with Hugh Jackman was a phenomenon. That movie fed off the soundtrack, which fed off the movie. I mean, the soundtrack to that film is still in the top 10 in North America. And in the Billboard charts, Mary Poppins Returns, that soundtrack, that peaked at number 90. And this week it's at 101 and falling. That could turn around. It doesn't matter for the film, but don't compare these two films. However, it's a family film. It got friendly reviews. It could get a boost from Oscar nominations. Not that it deserves it, but it could. And that means it could, you know, run for quite a while. Movie musicals tend to have long legs and people take a little while to get out to them. So the story is far from written on this. It's only in 38 territories, but it's a modest start. Aquaman crushed Mary Poppins in North America. And it's not a competition, but it is. No, you haven't seen it?
I have not seen it. No, I haven't seen any of these movies because I've been traveling.
Oh, I thought you might have seen it before. It is a bizarrely slavish imitation of the first Mary Poppins movie. If you haven't seen that film, you might like it okay. If you've seen the first one, you're like, every single scene is like the original. Literally, it's unbelievable. At the end, instead of flying a kite, they fly a balloon. You're like, good God, really? I mean, it's really bizarre. But anyway, one of the best films of the year, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. That made $45 million over the weekend. That's at $215 million worldwide. Great reviews. They're doing a sequel. I wish it was doing better, but it's having solid legs. Eight legs, I guess. And it's going to triple its budget. So this is definitely a win, certainly creatively and solidly commercially. So it'll be cool to see if the sequel can build on it or the spinoffs that they're planning. But it is a very unique looking animated movie, and I'm really happy to see how well it's doing.
And you've seen it?
Yes, yes. I said it was one of the best films of the year.
Okay.
Yeah. At number five is Dr. Seuss's The Grinch. This animated film has really crushed Ralph Breaks the Internet, which is at number six. Dr. Seuss cost $75 million to make. It's at $470 million worldwide. Now, that really will fall off a cliff because the holidays are over, but that's plenty of money. It's doing great, and it's going to be a seasonal favorite. Though, again, I don't know why you wouldn't watch the original special. Ralph Breaks the Internet, however, got much better reviews, and it's doing $20 million over the weekend. That's at $350 million worldwide. That's about double its budget. So it really needs to keep going and chug along. But it's already open in a lot of big territories. Yeah, it's not over yet. It'll probably eke out an okay final number. But it's not the success story they deserve since they did get really good reviews. Maybe they took too long. Maybe it was too meta. Who knows? But it has not clicked with audiences the way Dr. Seuss's The Grinch did. At number seven, this is awesome, Kill Mobile. This is a Chinese remake of that Italian comedy. Remember that comedy about a dinner party and everyone says, hey, let's put our phones in the middle of the table?
Worst idea ever.
Nobody would ever do it in real life, but this sucker
you didn't finish saying it. So for those who don't know, everybody puts their phones in the middle of the table and then they read the text messages that come in.
Or who's calling you? Oh, it's their lover. Oh, hello. You know, it's just so ridiculous. But China's remade it now. They're like the 10th country and it's a smash hit in China. I can't remember any film remade in country after country so quickly that's been so commercially successful everywhere it happens. $20 million on its opening weekend. And darn you, Harvey Weinstein, That's the only reason we haven't seen it here in the U.S.
Yeah, you know what? Who knows? Maybe it's all you need is a handful of actors and a table to make this movie, right?
Yeah.
And a camera, I guess. But maybe it's one of those ideas that in real life sounds like a horrible idea that you would never do in real life, but that makes actually a really good movie.
Well, it's supposed to be fun and commercial. I don't know anybody thinks it's a great film, but yeah, it's certainly commercial. And I would be intrigued to see the English language version. At number 8 is Bohemian Rhapsody. This sucker just keeps going and going. This is really a phenomenon. $20 million over the weekend. It has now passed the $700 million mark worldwide. Now, who directed Bohemian Rhapsody?
Bryan Singer, officially.
Official, not officially. He directed the movie. He directed 95% of it. He, all but the last 2 weeks of filming, Bryan Singer oversaw it. And this movie has grossed $700 million worldwide. We've heard all sorts of horror stories about Bryan Singer, and they didn't begin with Bohemian Rhapsody. He doesn't show up. He's late, whatever. Guess what? People are going to continue to work with him because the movie has made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I think they'll absolutely work with him because who knows what was going on there with him.
Well, we know again and again he's crazy that he doesn't show up on the set or he shows up late. He's done this movie after movie, and yet they keep working with him because the end result made money. So for all the trouble with him, they don't care how awful or annoying or what a pain someone is if they think they can make money off you.
Right, but you say it's a phenomenon. Let's face it, it was based on the music of Queen and the history of Queen, a rock band that has been around for 40 years that,
it's one of the biggest bands of all time.
Yeah,
but you can make a biopic about Led Zeppelin and the Beatles and the Stones, and you're not guaranteed a hit film.
Yeah,
no,
that's
way.
True. Now, did you ever hear Adam Lambert sing with Queen?
I've seen him on American Idol sing with Queen. I've never gone to a concert.
And how was that? I have never seen it. I guess I could look it up on YouTube and maybe spare our listeners.
He's a fine, he's a fine big belting singer, a la Freddie Mercury. He's a fine person to step in that role.
Okay.
Not that they're creating good new albums, but you want to see Queen, Freddie's dead, it's perfectly fine. It's closer to a tribute band than an actual band, but it's the original other guys. So, why not? And number 9 is Mojin, the Worm Valley. This is a Chinese fantasy adventure about grave robbers, sort of an Indiana Jones-style flick. It's a sequel to an original film. It began as a self-published online book, then it went into print, then it was a video game, then it became a big hit movie. The new sequel has come out, and unlike the original, it's not done great. It opened to $16 million. Now, the original only cost $40 million, so I don't know what this one cost, but they may end up being okay, but reviews were horrible. People really didn't like it. It made $16 million in 2 days. The original made $93 million in 3 days. So whatever goodwill there was for the original film, the sequel did not capitalize on it. At number 10 is Clint Eastwood's The Mule. That made $11 million over the weekend. That's at $60 million and counting. It's only in North America. We'll have to see if it translates as a low-key drama thriller in other territories or whether they see it as some sort of political Clint Eastwood film. But it's doing its job here in North America.
Did that movie get any decent reviews? I know there was some talk for a while that, it's going to be a dark horse coming up and...
Well, any Clint Eastwood film is an Oscar contender until you see it. But I think that talk has ended, but I don't recall the reviews as such, but I think they were polite.
Okay.
But they were not polite to Holmes and Watson, the John C. Reilly and who's the other guy?
Oh, Will Ferrell?
Will Ferrell, thank you. Yes, they did a hilarious spoof of Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, and the world hated it. I mean, poisonously bad reviews. It made $11 million on the weekend. This weekend, it's at $23 million and counting. But boy, people really, really did not like this movie. And I'm including critics and audience members. It was just viciously reviewed.
You know, when they showed this clips of this film at CinemaCon this year, and I think it was Sony Pictures that did that. I mean, people were looking at each other like, why did they just show us that? And I thought to myself, well, they probably contractually had to show it to us because otherwise the filmmakers, agents and the...
you got to promote it.
Yeah, you have to basically go out there and promote it even though you kind of know, this is a dud. I mean,
they opened it up on Christmas Day without showing it to critics.
Yeah, well, there you go.
That may be the first Christmas Day release ever not shown to critics. You know, that's that doesn't happen. You know, if it's that movie's so bad you don't want to show it to critics, why are you opening it up on Christmas Day?
Well, because what you're telling every newspaper critic and maybe every critic period in the United States is, guess what? You're working on Christmas Day.
Yeah, if they want to bother. Right. At number 12 is Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald. That has now chugged past $600 million worldwide. They said it cost $200 million to make, so it's in the black. We've got three more Fantastic Beasts films to come. We'll see if they shorten that to four after this one didn't do so great, but it's doing all right. And number 13 is Jennifer Lopez in Second Act, a modest romantic comedy, very modest. They say it only cost $16 million to make. I guess there's no names in it, but that still seems awfully inexpensive. But it made $8 million on the weekend. It's at $30 million and counting, a little bit below that. It'll be okay when all is said and done. I actually saw it for some bizarre reason. I don't know why or how that happened. You know what? Jennifer Lopez, she's a movie star. She's appealing on screen, especially in a film like this. It just was a dreadful movie. That's all. And number 14 is an Oscar hopeful, Vice, that did great at the Golden Globes, but it didn't help it at the box office. $8 million on the weekend. It did better than Holmes and Watson over the Christmas few days, but that's not saying much. It's at $18 million and counting. Audiences just seem to be like, oh, I don't know what. It's political. Is it humor? Is it a drama? So they seem a little underwhelmed, but Christian Bale's performance and transformation makes it something I want to check out. At number 15 is Take Point. That's something I don't want to do when I'm serving in NAM.
What?
Well, you don't want to take point. My men might frag me. I don't know. I don't trust them. But anyway, it's a Korean.
Are you just like making words up now?
It's Take Point. It's what you do when you take point, when you go out on a, you know, when you take your unit out into the jungle. Okay. Anyway, this has nothing to do with NAM. It's a Korean action film, actually, about a CIA operation to apprehend a North Korean official, which may lead to world war. So it's a Korean action film, $6 million on the weekend. I'm not sure what it cost, but we'll have to see where that ends up. And number 16 is The Morning After. This is a Chinese road comedy, and we think it's about three misfit guys who decide to try and rescue some dolphins. I think they're in a, you know, a SeaWorld-type place. Terrible reviews for this movie. This, too, made about $6 million. And number 17 is a German sort of comic drama. I won't try the German, and the English translation is ours. It might be The Boy Needs Some Fresh Air, or The Boy Must Go to the Country. That might be a more succinct way of translating it, though it's not as literal. Anyway, it seems to be about this kid. His mom dies. He's a high-spirited boy. He's sent to the grandparents in the country. He likes to wear women's clothes a lot, but it's hard to tell whether he's gay or just wants to be on stage. He just seems to be a cut-up. So we're not quite sure what's going on with this movie, but it's made $6.8 million so far. At number 18 is another animated Asterix and Obelix film. It's from France. It's made $5 million over the weekend. It's at $25 million in counting, so there'll probably be a third one. And number 19 is another big flop, Thugs of Hindustan. This is an Indian period action drama. It was perhaps the most expensive Bollywood film yet. It cost $50 million to make. It was a horrible flop, even though it starred the big star, Aamir Khan. It was so bad he apologized to people in India for the film, and he worked really hard in China. He learned some slang Chinese. He was eating dumpling. He was on New Year's. He was just working the circuit, pounding the pavement, doing everything he could, and it did not help. This movie opened to $4 million in China, even though he's a really big star there. He's had three big hits in a row. It's at $10 million total. And again, like Holmes and Watson and some other flicks, people are just running in the opposite direction. There's a lot of good news at the top of the charts, a lot of successful films, but, you know, there are some duds, too, like Mortal Engines. That's not picking up steam anywhere. That Peter Jackson-produced fantasy epic, probably intended to be the first of a franchise, but that ain't going to happen. That's at $62 million worldwide. A franchise that is working is the Singham franchise. That's an Indian series, sort of an action drama series, and the new movie Simba is a spinoff from it. It's a film about a corrupt cop who turns good after tragedy strikes. And it is a spinoff from that original series, which was about a good cop under stress. And this, too, like the worldwide remakes of that Italian comedy about people sitting around for dinner with the mobile phones. This movie, interestingly, began as a Tamil film. Then it was filmed in Hindi, then Kannada, then Bengali, then Punjabi. I mean, it's been made in five languages just for the Indian market alone. Now they're looking at doing it in Urdu. that may be happening. So this is a, you know, people, I love it when translated films, or I mean films with subtitles, play all over the world. That's really cool. And it's cool when movies work everywhere, like a lot of Hollywood films do. But boy, people really want to hear themselves on screen. They want to see themselves on screen. And there is a big hunger to see good stories done in your own language by people who look and talk like you. So a movie like the Singham franchise is a good example of that. Anyway, this movie opened up to $3.8 million. They're probably modestly budgeted about $1.5 million. So it's off to a great start. And at number 22 is Dragon Ball Z, Super Broly. That's the 20th in the franchise. Just like the Asterix and Obelix film in France, this one has made $25 million. So there'll probably be a 21st film.
So you that got 22 movies, a lot of movies.
A lot of movies. Yeah, there's a lot to cover. You know, Aquaman was a massive hit. Mary Poppins is doing fine. We'll have to see where it ends up, but it's certainly not the big smash hit they were hoping for. But the story could be good when all is said and done, and maybe there will be a return to Mary Poppins beyond her return. Bumblebee is a flop. Spider-Man's a hit. The Grinch did great. Ralph Breaks the Internet is doing okay. Some big hits around the world. It was not a strong end of the year, really. But there's a lot of art films still looking to do good, like that Ruth Bader Ginsburg film and Roma. They're now rolling out Roma in 70 millimeter, sort of a roadshow production, seeing the movie in 70 millimeter for 1 week only in various cities around the country. It just feels sort of like...
And it's not 1 week. It's just a couple days in Los Angeles. It's 2 days.
All right. And a week later, they go 2 or 3 or 4 days somewhere else.
It's a real roadshow. It's like you literally have, I mean, I guess a roadshow used to be 1 week, but now this is like they're striking a print and bringing that print city to city.
I think I'm anthropomorphizing a streaming service, but it feels so, you know, begrudging. Like if they were going to do this, it should have been announced in advance. We should have known it was going to happen. It shouldn't be a surprise. And it just feels, well, if it's good enough to show in 70 millimeter, why not let it stay there? Why for just 3 days?
Well, you know? And I have to be honest, I would have seen this movie in the theater if it hadn't opened around Christmas time, if I hadn't been traveling. You know, I went, you know, on 2 week-long trips during the month of December, and I would have gone to the movie theater to see it. I just did not have the time.
It's not playing still in LA?
It's not playing. It's playing in, like, I think one or two locations. So I'd have to...
Well, that's as many as it ever opened in, really.
Well, no, it was playing in a number of locations here in Los Angeles.
Oh, okay.
You know, you can see it in, like, you know, at least 10.
Oh, that's more than New York, for sure.
It's almost more than Mexico City. But, yeah, I think I would definitely go see it on the big screen. But now I'm not going to drive all the way to, you know, I don't know, Long Beach to see this movie.
Well, you know, it's people didn't have to leave their house to see Bird Box. This felt like the biggest film of the Christmas week. Forget Aquaman. It was this Sandra Bullock horror film, or, you know, tense film, sort of like A Quiet Place, really. Earth is invaded. Adults have to wear blindfolds, or if they look around the world, they'll see their greatest fears materialize. So Sandra Bullock spends the film trying to navigate things blindfolded. But it was a massive hit on Netflix, according to Netflix. They say... like 45 million views of the movie, or maybe 45 million people watched it, or maybe 45 million accounts accessed it. I'm not quite sure what metric they're using, but the number 45 million people was thrown around a lot. So this film with Sandra Bullock just played on Netflix, and people, you know, went crazy for it. They loved it. I knew like multiple nieces and nephews who were talking about the film. Adults were talking about the film. They were all sort of watching this horror flick right around Christmas, the bizarre Christmas choice. And that must make Netflix say, leave us alone. We just want to show movies and have people watch our streaming service. Nobody's yelling at us about Bird Box. Just leave us alone. You know, they didn't have to play that in the movie theaters. Maybe they would have made
actually,
a lot of money.
People they are yelling care. At them. I can't tell you the number of film buyers on my Facebook feed who were like, hey, thanks a lot, Netflix. You know how much money this could have made in the movie theater?
That's like yelling at HBO for making Game of Thrones or a hit TV film.
Well, but
that's not,
you know,
their bit. That's not their job. They made a TV movie that made a lot of money. That was a big hit for him.
Well, and there are, you know, a lot of people saying, or a lot of the trade press saying, you know, you say 45 million accounts viewed it, but what does that really mean? Is it 45 right. million people? Like they're saying, look, your opaqueness here, we're reporting on it, but we really shouldn't be because we're wondering what the heck it even means.
Right. It might mean 20 million views and they average out maybe 2.2 people watching every viewing, you know, right. when they add it all up, something like that. Who knows? But they're claiming a hit. People believe them. But you know what? Brian's song was on TV. Did anybody yell at them and say, why didn't you show that in a theater? You know, there's stuff made for TV. This one worked. They must feel like we don't need the bother of box office. They get yelled at no matter what they do. If they do a limited release, if they do a wider release, if they do a road show, they get yelled at. So they're like, just let us make our movies and be happy.
Well, the North American box office, I guess you could say it was happy, or it was definitely up, that's for sure. And it was bigger than the Chinese box office this year. North American box office was $11.9 billion, up 7%. Again, this is all estimated until about March, when they actually come in and say, no, this is how much, here's the official MPA report, which is why we don't have a lot of countries in right now. And very often what you'll hear is, oh, Germany was down the last year. And you'll hear that, you know, January 3rd. Or December 31st, or, you know, in early January. And then later, the true number comes out and it's a little different, and nobody ever goes back to correct themselves. They just use the new number moving forward. But preliminary reports, $11.9 billion in the U.S. Everybody thought it might.
It's an all-time record.
Yeah, it might squeak past $12 billion.
It's an all-time record.
That's not a complaint. That's, you know, I'm just kind of saying, you know, there was some reporting and prognosticating, so to speak, about it being, you know, a potential $12 billion year. Wasn't, however, all-time record, as you say. Chinese box office sets a record as well, $8.7 billion.
That's right, but they didn't grow nearly as fast. They grew about 2.7%. I forget what they grew, but it wasn't much. In fact, North American box office grew faster than the Chinese box office. That's how movie-going crazy North Americans are. So it's an almost $12 billion market. The Chinese box office will have to grow 50% just to catch up, and that's if the North American box office remains standing still. That's not going to happen. A very mature market, but it still continues to grow. The worldwide box office is also a record, $41.7 billion. And again, the big market leading the way, North America. After all these years, such a mature market, we're still showing a lot of strength. Remember last year when they said the bottom had fallen out, no one's going to go to the movies anymore, the world is dead? You know, even though 2016 had been a great year, 2017 wasn't as big. Now 2018, they're yelling again. If 2019 is down compared to this year, they'll scream again that the box office is dying. The fact is, North America is about 30% of the worldwide box office, and China is just under 20%. So 50% of the entire world market comes from North America and China. The rest of the world has a lot of catching up to do, and there's a lot of room to grow.
Well, and you know, there's some population discrepancies with the rest of the world as well. So you've got 1.4 billion people in China. You've got 300 plus million people in North America.
And you've got 7 billion people in the rest of the world.
Right. No, but I mean, country by country, you know, you can't really compare, say, an Iceland with even the UK. I don't even know how many, you know, screens they have in Iceland.
But 20% of the population, or maybe 23 or 25%, has 50% of the box office. So there's a lot of room to grow for the rest of the world.
Yeah. Oh,
75% of the world's population only accounts for 50% of the boxes. So there's a lot of room to grow. But there's good news everywhere you look. North America, Chinese, international, worldwide, everybody was up. Everybody set records, all-time records. And millennials, you always want to look at them and make sure they've got the habit. They seem to have the habit. Two-thirds of moviegoers were aged 18 to 44. That's actually 64.4% of the U.S. market were millennials or people in that age group. That's a great sign for the future, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, Michael, I have said year in, year out, the most important figure when it comes to box office is always attendance.
And that's what we really don't have yet. We have a good sense of the North American box office. We know we're right about on point on that number. But ticket sales, all they'll ever give us in the end is they'll take the total box office, average out by the entire year's average ticket price, which even varies quarter to quarter, so they shouldn't even do that, and give us a really rough estimate of ticket sales. That's all we got to go by. But I think it'll be a good year. It'll certainly be up. You know, some of the good news, we set records in four different months. One-third of the year set a new record. We set a new record for February, April, June, and October. And that's part of the story about expanding to year-round movie going, which we've been calling for decades, and has finally happened. 4 months of the year set new records, and it wasn't just December and July, you know, like it usually is. It was February, October, April. This is great news for the box office.
Yeah, I mean, look, anytime that you can break a record that was substantial to begin with, is a good year.
Unfortunately, one record that was also broken was the average ticket price. In the summer, the average ticket price was $9.38. It's a lot of money.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do a, and I know that people have done this, so I'd just be kind of be a redundant study of the rate of inflation from, I don't know, since they started tracking this figure of ticket price versus the rate of inflation on tickets.
Well, no, it's good. If you go back to the 70s and the early 80s, tickets are still reasonably priced. They were a little bit more expensive back in the 70s and the 80s. So tickets have not increased dramatically in terms of of inflation. But of course, you're looking at an average throughout the nation as opposed to what people pay in New York and LA versus what they pay in the Heartland and smaller cities and towns and suburbs. You know, a lot of when I go to my brother's, I'm not paying $15, $18. I'm paying $8.
Yeah, it's not a weighted average. It's the average.
Right, but when you look at the ticket price from the 70s and the early 80s, it was more expensive compared to today. So you keep putting that in perspective. It's like, yeah, you know what? Tickets are, you know, they are what they are, but they're not more than they were 30 years ago.
And
so
by the way,
they're not really jacking it up a lot.
Don't be surprised if this year, next year, 2019, that, you know, the attendance and the box office goes down and dips just a bit. And here's why.
We just set a record.
We just set a record, number one. And we had a phenomenon with Black Panther. That movie just was, it set all sorts of records. I mean, one of the months that you cite, Michael, February, that was when Black Panther came out. That's why that month set a record.
Well, there are always new movies that are going to be phenomenons that you don't know about, like It. Or whatever, you know, there's always going to be movies coming out of nowhere that will surprise you.
Yeah, correct.
So, you know, we'll have to see what happens. I mean, there are probably some big films in January and February that, you know, Glass comes out in January, the M. Night Shyamalan film based on the, you know, those vaguely superheroish characters with Samuel L. Jackson and Bruce Willis et al. And the fine Scottish actor.
Yeah, you know, that guy. I know exactly who you're talking about. The guy that is probably confused with everybody else. And it's
James McAvoy.
Yes.
Sorry about that, Mr. McAvoy. You know, February has How to Train Your Dragon. The first one was a big hit. The new one could be, you know, you never know where big hits are going to come from. March has Captain Marvel. They'll probably set a record for March.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, Captain Marvel, if it's any good. Even if it's not any good, it'll probably make a mint.
And Dumbo comes out in March, the live action Dumbo. You know, there's a big movies in January. Shazam comes out in April. Hellboy, Pet Sematary, Avengers Endgame comes out in April. You know, there's a lot of movies coming out, and they come out year round. And in China, they need to come out because while the box office grew year to year, December was a little slow.
Yeah, you know, that's true. And before we move on to China for just a second, we should do an episode every year. Like the last episode of the year, we should do, what movies do you think will be the big hits of the following year? We just, you know, take a swag and then kind of go back and review it at the end of the year. But in any case, you're talking about China, and all those movies that we select could wind up in China. In fact, even more so now than ever, because, I don't know, the holiday season, the Christmas holiday season, which is not as big in China. It is in certain parts of China, like Hong Kong, Taiwan, etc. But it didn't do as well this year. Movie going was down. And they're going to be relaxing the quota officially.
Well, they did. You know, they said, well, we need more movies. The year is slowing down. We don't have enough films. And so they shoveled in some movies like The Grinch, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, John Cho's Searching. All those films came out in the last few weeks of the year because China knew they did not have enough. Even with throwing those in the mix, they still did not make up enough ground to save December or the holiday season. But they knew, you know what?
We need film. Who predicted that, by the way? Who predicted that again?
It might be us.
Yeah, I've been saying that forever. Like, you keep building cinemas, you keep building grocery stores. You know what that means? You're going to need groceries to put on those shelves.
Yes, and they even approved Uncle Drew. That's coming out early next year. Why they would put the flop film Uncle Drew into China, I have no idea. The old guys playing basketball based on a commercial. I mean, why that would get released in China, who knows? It's the mysterious Orient. No, I shouldn't say that.
Well, I don't know. I guess you don't have any book filter news for us, do you?
No books come out after Thanksgiving. Black Friday, everything's in the stores. So, you know, I've got books on my website, but not a lot's happening there. But a lot is happening in sexual misconduct news. Kevin Spacey is officially charged with felony sexual assault in Massachusetts. This involves an incident with an 18-year-old man who met him in a restaurant and says that Spacey, you know, assaulted him at the restaurant. Kevin Spacey's people say, there's video. They say it doesn't show anything improper or illegal, blah, blah, blah. But the bizarre thing here is Kevin Spacey, after going into silence, decided to release a video.
Yeah, this is the craziest thing. And I guess it was like right before Christmas he did this?
Yeah, it was like Christmas Day or the day before Christmas Eve, something like that.
I was just baffled. I couldn't believe that he did this, and I just thought, who is advising him? Has he lost his mind?
No one advised him to do that. He chose to do that, obviously. He posted a video in the character of Frank, the guy from House of Cards, and made sort of mocking references to what was going on and saying how, you're not assuming someone is innocent without all the evidence, are you? You know, and it was just crazy.
No, you're not assuming somebody is guilty without all the evidence. That's
or guilty, yes. No, it was just a bizarre, mocking, nutty, what in God's name were you thinking move. And then, like a few days later, according to TMZ, he went out and delivered pizza to the paparazzi that are stalking him outside his mansion. You know, so his plan apparently was to lay low for a while and then post a crazy video. But you can see all these people thinking they're going to make a comeback. Matt Lauer placed a story somewhere saying 1 year later, how Matt Lauer's getting on after, you know, his days in the wilderness. So he's hoping, you know, people say, oh, how is Matt Lauer doing? I've forgiven him or forgotten about all that. I wonder what he's doing next. You know, Charlie Rose, all these people think they're going to come back. They're all plotting. Mario Batali, someone was talking to me last night about, oh, well, here's what he's going to do. He's going to, you know, do work with some charities and then get back into the public eye. You know, they all think they're going to make a comeback, and some of them will.
And Mario Batali, I mean, he's a chef. He could make a comeback just as a chef.
Well, then what else would he make a comeback as? What are you talking about? No, there are restaurants that he owned that have distanced themselves from because they don't want his name anywhere near them.
True.
They don't want anything to do with Mario Batali. They don't want, you know, people to have a reason not to go to their restaurant. So it's not, of course, he'd come back as a chef. What the hell else would he be? That's all he is, a chef. But he has a sullied name and reputation. And he has not redeemed himself yet. I'm not sure or aware of any charity work or trying to make amends or showing he's a new man or what he's done in that regard. But that's what all these people think they should do. But Kevin Spacey said, you know what? I'm going to set some TNT to this puppy and see what happens.
Well, he most certainly did do that.
He got a lot of hits. He got a lot of hits, millions of hits really quickly because people are like, what the heck is this? It's ultimately, it'll be a big whoop. And I don't think it'll hurt him legally, but not a smart idea.
Well, wait a second. You said big whoop, okay? And that means it must be time for our last big deal or big whoop segment for this year. Big deal or big whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story this week, the holiday weeks can be, you know, a little slow for news, so everyone jumped all over a rumor from Gossip Rag TMZ right before Christmas. It claimed Maroon 5 had signed up some other acts to join their halftime show at the Super Bowl. Rapper Travis Scott was said to be on board while Cardi B was holding out for more money and the chance to do one of her solo hits as well as a duet with Adam Levine and the gang. By the time everyone else repeated the rumor, it seemed to be all but confirmed, except nearly 2 weeks later, we're still waiting for word as to whether it's true or actually just a rumor. That hasn't stopped the Reverend Al Sharpton from condemning Scott for taking part and new rumors that Jay-Z was trying to talk him out of it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I'm sure this will be outdated by the end of the week, right? I mean, it's getting to be just a few weeks away from the game. They've got to announce, you've got to start naming people or they're not going to have time to set it up and make it happen. So it's going to have to happen this week. If these people are on board, they're going to have to announce it very, very soon so they can start the planning and rehearsing and all that stuff and figure out what they're going to do. So I'm sure we will be, outdated by breaking news, maybe by the end of the day. But something's got to happen. Well, not today, because today's New Year's Eve. But boy, oh boy, this is crazy. And God help them next year. I still say Up With People should get ready, because they're going to be back at the Super Bowl.
CBS pays Nielsen about $100 million a year. Not only does CBS think that's too much, as do I, they now believe Nielsen's once vaunted overnight ratings are costing them money. People consume TV shows in more ways than ever before, and CBS says they're missing too many of those eyeballs. They now get info on audiences from other sources like ComScore and their own ways and think maybe, you know, they don't need Nielsen so much anymore. Nielsen insists this is just a negotiating tactic on the part of CBS and they'll come to an agreement, so big deal or big whoop.
Well, I think it's a big whoop right now because it would only be a big deal if they actually dropped them. But CNBC really did drop Nielsen entirely, since so much of their audience is on trading floors or in bars and restaurants in Wall Street and watching on TVs and office spaces, that they felt Nielsen was just irrelevant to their audience and tracking who was doing it and how much. I think, though, CBS is not in charge here. Advertisers are in charge. If they want these numbers, CBS has to keep paying Nielsen. If they say, we're willing to go to the Wild West and take, you know, not one standard, but a million different standards and figure out what happens, well, then all hell will break loose. But until the advertisers say they don't need Nielsen, I don't think they can budge.
With Aretha Franklin's death and her classic concert film Amazing Grace finally in theaters, everyone is poring over everything they know about the Queen of Soul, including the IRS, apparently, and the IRS, for those who don't know, the Internal Revenue Service here in the United States. It's unclear if unpaid taxes were an ongoing dispute or just popped up, but TMZ first reported Franklin owed some $8 million in back taxes and penalties. Her estate says they have already paid some $3 million, but that they dispute various other claims by the IRS, which they say doesn't understand the music business or why Franklin would have so many expenses when touring. Sooner or later, it'll be settled, no doubt, but for now, we know one of the great singers of all time liked to be paid in cash, hated signing contracts, and just like everyone else, she hated paying taxes. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. You know, right now the IRS has less than 10,000 employees, and they haven't had that few number of employees in 60 years, since the 50s, and that was when the country was a heck of a lot smaller. So the fewer IRS people there are, the more people will cheat.
TV personality Tucker Carlson, is he a, I guess he's a personality, not necessarily a journalist.
He's absolutely not a journalist. Yeah.
He has been behaving more and more like a brash white supremacist, and it's finally caught up with him. He's just now behaving that way? Interesting.
More and more.
Yeah. Well, 2 years into the Trump administration, Carlson has upped the ante on hate-filled rhetoric filled with lies and ugly stereotypes. So it's not that Carlson suddenly went too far. It's just that 2 years of increasingly unhinged talk simply became too much. The final straw? A rant in which Carlson tagged immigrants as making our country, the United States that is, poorer and dirtier. Dirty to describe immigrants is simply too Nazi-ish, even for the folk who still advertise on Fox News. One advertiser pulled out, and then another, and then another, and now the count is up to 19 advertisers walking away. Carlson, of course, denounces this as an attack on free speech, though, of course, it's not. He's free to say whatever he wants, and advertisers are free to say they don't want to be associated with what he says. You don't see Louis Farrakhan getting a lot of mainstream advertisers either, do you? Big deal or big whoop?
Louis Farrakhan?
Louis Farrakhan.
Louis. I had to keep changing the number. It looks like it's up to 24 advertisers is the latest number. I literally changed it day after day after day, and I forgot to check. It now looks like, according to the rap, we're up to 25 advertisers. So, that's hurting him. But, you know, they can promote other Fox News shows. They're sticking by him. But, yeah, it's fun to see. I mean, before, when I say he's becoming more and more like a white supremacist, originally he just seemed like a snarkier George Will, you know, when he was at CNN on Crossfire or whatever. Then he just became more and more, you know, kind of like the business guy. What's his name? Who became unhinged on immigration. He seemed relatively sane, and then he got worse and worse and worse.
Not Lou Dobbs.
Yeah, Lou Dobbs. Yeah, oh. You know, in the early days, he was just talking about business, but suddenly he hit immigration and became, you know, he got red meat, and suddenly everybody loved him on the far right, and he just got worse and worse and worse. So, you know, for a while, we didn't know what a crazy person he was.
Sean Hannity, I'm surprised, is still going strong. I mean, some of the stuff he says is just boldly not true. I mean, it's just completely false. And the fact that advertisers are like, yeah, we're fine with that.
Yeah, no, he's the number one show on Fox News.
I know. It's unbelievable. Speaking of number one, okay, it's not the biggest tour ever. Some tours last 2 or 3 years, and Bob Dylan has jokingly been touring for the past 30 years. He's never stopped. But Ed Sheeran grossed more money from touring in 2018 than any artist has ever done in a single calendar year. That, I had to go back and check that, actually, you know, and that's true.
That's according to Billboard.
Yeah, he hit $432 million. In 2018 alone, from February through the end of the year. Even more impressively, the tour began early in 2017, so he's actually grossed $555 million, and that makes his Divide tour the third biggest of all time, behind U2 and the Rolling Stones, which is who I was going back to check against, but those tours started in 1 year and ended in another. He's still going strong, with a lot more shows through August of 2019. But even if his ticket sales remain strong, he won't come close to U2's $735 million from their 360 tour. Hey, give him another decade or two, and maybe Bono won't be so cocky. Meanwhile, Taylor Swift set a record for the biggest grossing tour in U.S. history in a single year, and her lifetime ticket sales are about to hit $1 billion. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
He has three albums. Three. That's it. He has Add, and the other album called Multiply, and the latest album is Divide, which I guess means his next album will be Square Root or something like that. But that's amazing with three albums. He has really built up his touring audience with steady, steady touring, not stratospheric ticket prices, a lot of bigger and bigger venues, a slow build, you know, and this is great news for the touring for years to come. Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, and others like them. These are young acts that are going to be around for a long time. This guy's just getting going.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I guess this week we're going to be talking about movie-going habits versus people who stay home and just stream movies, which apparently is not affecting those who go to the movies, according to a new study. The study was asking, is Netflix killing the habit of movie going? And NATO, the North American Theater Owners Association, we mentioned them earlier in the show, they wanted to find out, of course. So they commissioned a study by the firm EY. Is that Ernst & Young? I don't know who that is.
Oh, maybe it is. It was just abbreviated, so I don't think it is, but maybe I'm wrong. Ernst & Young is accounting, aren't they?
Yeah, well, yeah, but they do all sorts of stuff like this. Right. You know, they're always doing research. Now that the study interviewed 2,500 people, which is, of course, a huge sampling of the movie-going public, he said sarcastically. They did this survey in November of 2018, and the results, it turns out, nope, Netflix doesn't harm movie-going at all. Nope, not according to the study.
So what was the first finding about heavy moviegoers?
Well, heavy moviegoers, the two forms of entertainment are, in fact, apparently complementary. People who rent, who went to 9 or more movies, which is, of course, all of us. We all go to 9 movies a year. They consumed more streaming than people who only went to 1 or 2 films a year. So apparently people who go to the movies also watch a lot of movies at home. Shocking, absolutely nobody, actually.
Right, so let's make their case for them first. This study, as publicly promulgated by NATO with a summary, that's all we've been able to see online, and then it was reported in the trades. They said, hey, people who go to movies a lot also stream a lot of movies. They also say that most people go see at least one movie at the theater a year. So 80% of the population goes to see at least one film. So a lot of people go to the movies, and those who go a lot also stream a lot. And people who don't go to the movies, well, they don't stream much either. So if you never go to the movies, then you probably don't stream either that much. That's what they found. Almost half the people who didn't go to a single movie theater last year also didn't stream any online content. And we're talking about, they actually covered movie-going habits in 2017, but this, we don't need to worry about that. We're just talking about general movie-going habits. So people who go to the movies a lot, they stream a lot. Most people go to the movies at least once a year, and if you don't go to the movies, well, then you're not streaming much either. That's what the study says. And to me, it sounds like they're just being told what they want to hear, or they're trying to make the case that, hey, don't worry about movies, we're doing great. You know, it sounds like PR or just a poorly designed study. And again, we haven't seen it. We're just reporting on what they said. But a lot of this is sort of head scratching, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they also reported that most people go see at least one movie at the theater. 80% of the people who were reached during this study, again, only 2,500 people took place.
Well, I'm sure that's statistically, I'm sure they would say that the sampling was enough to do a valid survey.
I mean, right.
We'd love it if they spoke to a million people, but they say that's how sampling works in surveys, right? You know, you speak to 500 voters and you blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And, but yeah, they say 80%.
You find out that Hillary Clinton will win the election, and then actually on election night.
She 19, won the popular vote by the percentage that was predicted for months. Anyway, they say, most people go. Actually, 1 out of 5 people don't go to the theater. They don't go see a movie. That sounds like a lot to me. But maybe they're including babies, small children, elderly people who aren't ambulatory. I don't know when they say most people. Are they talking about adults? Are they talking about kids as well? So there's a lot we don't know about the survey. But guess what? If 20% of the population doesn't go to a movie, I find that pretty high, actually.
Well, and you know, those who don't go to the movies, guess what they don't do, actually? They don't watch movies via streaming either. You know, they just don't watch movies, probably.
Or TV much, yeah. I mean, when they said people who go to the movies 9 times a year or more also stream a lot, well, duh. People who go to rock concerts, they also listen to music at home. Of course they do. They love music. And the fact that they had to tell us what people who go to 9 movies or more a year, that's very suspicious. You know, we know that a heavy moviegoer is like 4 movies a year. If you go to a movie every quarter, that's really good. Hollywood's very happy to see you. That's a strong, solid moviegoer. 6 or 7 movies a year, that's even better. Every 8 weeks, you're going to a movie. 9 movies or more a year? I'd love to know how many people in this survey actually went to 9 or more movies a year. It feels like to me they went to where they could to make the best case that they could. They said, all right, just tell us the best story we can. Okay, well, if you look at people who went to 9 movies, yeah, they stream a lot, but they're going to a lot of movies. That's the best news we can give you. Because I want to know, well, what about the people who went to 4 movies a year or 3 movies or 5 movies? Because 9 is a heck of a lot. That's very unusual. And even more so, if you really want to know how streaming affects movie going, the survey, the study you need to do is people who go to the movies and then add a streaming service. Compare the before and after. That's what we need to know. I went to 5 movies a year, then I got Netflix, and I went to none, or I went to 10, or I went to 2. That's what you need to compare. And heck, what happens when you add a second service? That would be more telling. If you have Amazon Prime and Netflix, does that mean your movie going habits remain the same, get stronger, or drop? You know, that's the survey you need. That's the study you want. As far as we know, they didn't do that. And the information they're providing is a little suspicious. You're telling me about what people who go to 9 movies a year did? That's pretty unusual stuff. So it doesn't really tell us a lot. Maybe they're telling us what 30 people did. You know, that doesn't really give us a picture of movie going and how it's affected by streaming. Maybe they have that info and they don't want to share it. Maybe they don't like it. Maybe it's not good news.
We need to see the study. Show us the study.
Or maybe it just wasn't designed for anything other than PR purposes. Maybe they just wanted to hear good stories, good news. But yeah, I'd love to know anybody out there. If you know of a study comparing people movie going habits compared to before and after they added 1 or more streaming services, that's what we'd like to hear about. How would they reach us?
Well, they can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. They can also call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. They can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or they can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Something we'll be saying in just a few moments.
Sorry about that. But nonetheless, people will not be contacting us, some of them, because they're gone.
That's right. Including we're talk about Ringo Lam.
Yeah, well, Hong Kong director Ringo Lam died at 63. UK actress June Whitfield, you'll recognize her once we describe her career. She died at 93. Amos Oz, the Israeli author, died at 79. Norman Gimbel, the Oscar and Grammy winning lyricist, he died at 91. And perhaps most famously of all, certainly here in America, groundbreaking director Penny Marshall died at 75. She had a number one TV show, but I think her claim to fame really is directing. But let's start with Hong Kong director Ringo Lam. He died at 63 in his sleep. Have you ever seen his most important film, City on Fire?
I have not, actually.
Neither have I, but it's his big hit, followed by multiple sequels, Prison on Fire, School on Fire, and his last film was Sky on Fire. And Quentin Tarantino openly acknowledged his debt to Ringo Lam in the movie City on Fire. He ripped it off, or if you prefer, he paid homage to it in Reservoir Dogs. Ringo Lam had a good career. He studied with Chow Yun-fat. He started directing with comedies. He did a little Hollywood. Didn't quite work. But, you know, he had his one totemic film. And some people say, Quentin's a ripoff. He's a joke. You know what? Quentin's had a really good career, a bigger career than Ringo Lam, not to diss the poor guy who just died. But, you know, when your last film is Sky on Fire, you're still trying to capture that one big hit. Hey, that's cooler than most people. But I think Quentin, you know, he acknowledged the influence. He copied some cool, you know, moments in that movie and made them his own in Reservoir Dogs. And he paid tribute to him. So, you know, there's no reason, I think, to diss either of them. You got one film that caught worldwide attention. Good for you.
What was that old Picasso adage, you know, good artists steal, great artists plumage?
Plunder?
Plunder, yeah, sorry.
Pillage.
Pillage, yeah, plumage? What is plumage? Plumage is the... great artists actually grow feathers.
I didn't recognize June Whitfield's name, but I certainly know her work from Ab Fab. Did you recognize her name?
Vaguely.
Yeah. She's a big British star. I mean, she would be beloved and well-known there. She began working in radio gigs, had a hit sitcom in the late 70s, early 80s called Terry and June. And then she was a supporting role in Ab Fab, the absolutely fabulous TV series. She even did the voice of Miss Marple on BBC 4 Radio for 9 years. And radio really has even more prominence in the UK, I think, than in the US in a lot of ways. Certainly radio dramas and things like that do. She was in the Carry On film franchise. She was in Doctor Who. She was an episode of Friends. So she's done a long career, grown to be more and more beloved. In fact, when she was made a dame at 92, just a year ago, Prince Charles said this was long overdue. And his mom would agree. Even Queen Elizabeth loved her. She did an imitation of Whitfield's character from a radio show way back in 1953, a show called Take It From Here. And she did that imitation to Whitfield herself. Apparently she was meeting the queen and she pulled out her old imitation of one character that June played. That's got to be a pretty cool moment.
That's got to be an out-of-body experience.
Exactly. Normally the queen is like, and you, oh, and you make music, do you, Mr. McCartney? You know, that's normally how it goes.
Oh, you're very popular.
Yes, I've heard you're quite fab. Amos Oz is certainly a well-known public figure. An important author and memoirist and novelist and essayist, the voice, the conscience of Israel for many years. He died at 79. His most important work as a writer is probably reviving the Hebrew language for contemporary authors. In fact, he changed his name to Amos Oz. His last name means Hebrew for courage. He adopted that name. So it's like calling Michael Macho, you know, Amos Courage. So that's kind of cool.
By the way, from now on, that's your new name, Michael Macho.
Perhaps his most important novel is called My Michael. His memoir, A Tale of Love and Darkness, was just made into a film directed and starring Natalie Portman. His most recent collection of essays is Dear Zealot. He always fought against zealotry on the far left and the far right. Really, though, politically, he helped found the liberal group Peace Now. He was always a voice of conscience for Israel. He's been called a traitor again and again his entire life, sometimes by the left, but mostly by the right. And this is kind of cool. He separated his political and literary efforts. He would sit down to write, and if he was writing in one style, he would use blue ink. And if he was writing in black ink, he would use the other, you know, he was writing politics or one or the other. I've messed that up. Let me try that again. And this is kind of cool. When he would sit down to write, he wrote in a pen. And if he was writing for politics, he would use one color ink. And if he was writing for literary efforts, he would use another color ink. He said, you know, he used blue and black. And he said, one color is to tell the government to go to hell. The other one is to tell stories.
I'm going to start doing that. First, I have to start writing about the government, but then, you know, then I'm going to switch pens.
You'll use one font. Use one font. Yeah, there you go. Do you know Norman Gimbel?
You know what? Much like, June Whitfield, only vaguely. I did not know that Norman Gimbel had written Killing Me Softly with his song.
Yeah, he co-wrote it. He's a lyricist. That's a classic Roberta Flack hit, also covered by the Fugees. He worked in a lot of genres. He won an Oscar. He won a Grammy. He did TV theme songs. He did Broadway. He did classic standards. Really importantly, he wrote English lyrics for bossa nova hits. He did pop, R&B, you name it. I Got a Song, the Jim Croce hit, that was released the day after his plane crash. It was just an accident that it happened that way, but that was a big hit. He did the English lyrics for Girl from Ipanema, one of the most recorded songs of all time. And then TV. Well, TV. He did Happy Days, Angie, Paper Chase, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Are there words in that show? I didn't know there were words. And Wonder Woman. He did the lyrics for Wonder Woman in her satin tights, fighting for our rights, and the old red, white, and blue. Even at the time as a kid, I thought, that's a kind of a funny rhyme. He won the Oscar for the theme song from Norma Rae. He did the English lyrics for the French musical film, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. But you know why we're talking about Norman Gimbel, aren't we?
Well, he wrote the theme song for Laverne and Shirley.
Making our dreams come true. That's right. Though Penny Marshall actually came up with the Schlemiel Schlemazel. That was a goofy thing she and her friends did growing up. They kind of made it up themselves, and she incorporated that into the theme song. And of course, she is the last person we're talking about today. She died at 75, and it's kind of interesting. You know, big, big TV star, the number one TV show in the country, but all anybody really wanted to talk about was her directing career.
Yeah, she directed the movie Big. And she also directed the movie A League of Their Own, probably, and Awakenings, starring Robert De Niro and Robin Williams, but probably best known for Big and A League of Their Own.
Right. I mean, Big was the first film directed by a woman, to be a blockbuster. It grossed $100 million and really made Tom Hanks a superstar. She's also the first woman to direct the second film that made $100 million, which was A League of Their Own. She did two in a row. And that's huge. So that's her place in history. She was the second woman in history to see her film nominated for Best Picture. That was Awakenings with Robert De Niro. That followed Randa Haynes, who saw her film Children of a Lesser God nominated for Best Picture. And, you know, League of Their Own, she got great performances from Tom Hanks, Madonna, Gina Davis, Rosie O'Donnell. She was married to Rob Reiner from All in the Family in the 70s. They both had great film directing careers. And she shared a birthday with Carrie Fisher. And they had big, legendarily fun annual parties celebrating their birthday. I never want to go to parties. I kind of really wanted to go to that one and never got a chance.
Well, unfortunately now you probably, well, certainly over the last 2 years, you wouldn't have had a chance.
Well, they'll be doing it in heaven, I guess.
Yes.
So I take it you never went.
No, God, no, no.
Not important enough. Her brother, of course, was Gary Marshall, who created Happy Days. But she established herself as an actress, even without his help. She was on shows that he worked on, but also others like Mary Tyler Moore, Bob Newhart. She was in Paul Sands and Friends and Lovers. And, of course, she recurred on The Odd Couple, which was Gary's show. And then she was spun off from Happy Days, which was also his show. So, you know, interesting career. You know, two really good films, not a lot else to her credit as a director. She hasn't done a lot in recent years. Those were sort of happy accidents, but God bless her. You know, she made history, led the way for other women, and got a couple good movies to her credit. That's better than most.
Well, speaking of credits, it's time for our end credits, not only for this episode, but for this year. You can subscribe to our show in the iTunes, in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review us in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. It helps other people find our podcast. So please do rate and review us. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. As well as ways to contact us, as we mentioned earlier, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. We have a website at showbizsandbox.com. MGMT has a website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's schlemielschlemazel.com.
And good luck trying to spell that. And if you can't and do want to read some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, maybe head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next year, play nice.
Happy New Year, Spurly.
Happy New Year, Michael. Michael Macho from now on, by the way.